This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
At one barricade in central Khartoum Wednesday night, shouting matches broke out between protesters who agreed with their leader's orders to remove the blockades and those wanting the walls to stay put.
That's VOA's Jason Patinkin talking about disputes among groups of protesters in Sudan about whether to dismantle some of the barricades at their sit-in. Also, Niger's military says a total of 28 soldiers were killed in an ambush in the western part of the country. And Kenyan officials are again threatening to close down the Dadaab refugee camp, one of the world's largest. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, after days of violence in Khartoum left hundreds wounded and several dead, protest leaders ordered the removal of barricades around a sit-in where thousands have been demanding an end to military rule. But after the fighting, to expand the roadblocks against military encroachment, not all protesters agree with the order, leading to tense arguments. Jason Patinkin reports from Khartoum.
At one barricade in central Khartoum Wednesday night, shouting matches broke out between protesters who agreed with their leader's orders to remove the blockades and those wanting the walls to stay put. 19-year-old Salah Jalani, who before Sudan's revolution worked in an ice factory, denounced the call to remove the roadblocks. They keep asking us to remove one barricade after another, and eventually it will reach the sit-in, he said. These people shot at us earlier today, Jalani said, referring to security forces. I haven't even broken my fast today protecting this barricade. Why don't we just let them in if we're going to remove roadblocks, he asks sarcastically. A self-appointed transitional military council ousted President Omar al-Bashir on April 11th from 3 decades of power, but has resisted handing power back to the people. Twisted metal and stone barricades manned by revolutionary youth have blocked central Khartoum's roads and bridges since then, as protesters pressure Sudan's military leaders to give up power. The barricades protect a massive sit-in where thousands of protesters have camped out for weeks, demanding a return to civilian rule. But the roadblocks have also been sites of violence, as government security forces have fired on protesters. On Monday night, doctors say 77 people were shot at the barricades, with at least 4 deaths. Protest leaders blamed the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, a government-backed militia, for the violence. But on Wednesday night, the Sudan Professionals Association, or SPA, which leads the protest movement, ordered roadblocks pulled back to the original limits of the sit-in. The SPA's decision to stand down has become the first major dispute within Sudan's 5-month protest movement. Sanaa Ibrahim al-Hassan said the protesters, who are already sacrificing by living at the sit-in, need the barricades for protection. If the president wants these roadblocks removed, he should give us a civilian government. We deserve a civilian government, said Hassan. We can't just remove the roadblocks and every 2 days be attacked. The military demanded the barricades be dismantled during talks with protest leaders on forming a transitional government. This week's violence has overshadowed what appeared to be progress in the talks. The two sides have agreed on some issues, but remain at odds over whether civilians or military should dominate the next government before fresh elections in 2022. Even as the barricades were coming down, the military council Wednesday night suspended negotiations for 3 days. Iman Karoum, a mechanical engineer, said he understands some other protesters' concerns, but backing down was the right decision.
We
lost people 2 days ago, and today we've had more injured, he said. These people have seen their brothers standing with them this morning get shot, so it's natural to be against the roadblocks being removed, said Karum. Since April 6th, we've done everything with instructions from the SPA. We've managed to get into heavily militarized areas through their instructions and planning, he said. So what we want to do is go as far as we can through their instructions, said Karum. They've gotten us this far, he said. They're not going to let us down. But supporters of the decision to remove the barriers note that they could quickly be rebuilt if needed. Trader Sadegh Ahmed Al-Sadegh sat on a pile of bricks waiting to remove a barricade. We've reached 90% of what we want, he said, so there's only 10% left. If we get the 10% we need, said Sadegh, fantastic. If not, he said, we will expand the roadblocks again even bigger than before. Despite the opposition, by Thursday morning, most of the barricades outside the original sit-in area around Sudan's defense ministry were taken down. With talks on hold, protesters at the downsized sit-in will have to wait and see if their leaders made the right decision. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Khartoum.
An attack near the border with Mali has left 28 Niger soldiers dead. The bodies of 17 troops were found shortly after the attack Tuesday. An army spokesman said today that the bodies of 11 missing soldiers had been discovered near the village of Tongo Tongo. Reports say a military patrol discovered a group of armed men Tuesday. Heavy fighting followed. More than 20 soldiers escaped. The spokesman said no group has claimed responsibility for the attack. The area is known for ethnic militias and criminal groups. French, American, and United Nations forces have been deployed there. The border area where Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali meet and the Niger River flows is growing increasingly dangerous. In recent weeks, attacks by suspected Islamic militants have killed 10 people in nearby Burkina Faso. More than once in recent years, Kenyan officials have called for the closure of the Dadaab refugee camp. The camp in eastern Kenya hosts more than 200,000 refugees and asylum seekers. Many fled their homes during or since the 1991 civil war in Somalia. In February, Kenya's government wrote to the UN Refugee Agency ordering the camp closed by mid-year. Now, the fate of thousands of refugees living in the camp remains unclear. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
Mohammed Aden says his parents fled Somalia's Gedo region for Kenya 27 years ago. He was just 3 years old when they arrived at Dadaab. Now 30, Aden says that he was able to get an education, good health care, and a family of his own, who he says know no other home but Dadaab. Constant threats of its closure, he says, give them sleepless nights.
We don't have nice place to back in our country. We have been here as for almost 27 years. And now in our country now, what we have provided here for the first, the key is education, health, and also water, sanitation, all that we have, food even. We have provided here for the UNHCR. So for us, if you park there, no water, no, first key is no education, if you go to there. So if no education, it means that we'll bug in our country, no ice at all there.
The camp would be closed by the end of August if the Kenyan plan is followed through. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it's working with the Kenyan government to provide solutions. UNHCR Kenya representative Fatia Abdallah spoke to reporters.
As you know, that the camp has been in life since 1992. That generation born in Dadaab, and there are a large number of refugees living in Dadaab, more than 280,000. Therefore, we're looking for a solution. Everyone agreeing we should have a solution for that situation. And solution lies in different strategies. One, the voluntary repatriation to Somalia. As you know, the majority of refugees in Dadaab are from Somalia. And that program is ongoing.
Abdallah said relocation of some of the refugees to other parts of Kenya is another option.
I think we're hoping to relocate some of refugees in Dadaab to Kakuma. And again, that is not something we will force. We will talk to them and see who would like to be relocated to Kakuma, because we have an office there and we have a program there as well. And this is all jointly with the government.
Aden, like some of the refugees VOA spoke to, hopes his family will get resettled to a third country instead of being plucked from their home to a different part of Kenya. Abdallah says the UNHCR is listening.
Many of the refugees outside as well, they express their, they would like to be resettled. And that is something, as I said earlier, it's not in our hand. It is a small number, it takes longer, and it's for all vulnerable refugees, but we're trying our best also to address that.
In 2016, the Kenyan government said it would close Dadaab, asserting it was there that the 2013 Westgate terror attack was planned. But in 2017, Kenya's High Court said the move was unconstitutional and a violation of the UN Convention on Refugees. After the attack on the Dusit D2 hotel complex in Nairobi in January, there were fresh calls to close Dadaab after 12 suspects linked to the attack were arrested in Dadaab. For Aden, his request to the Kenyan government is that they hold off closing the camp, at least until peace returns to his country. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
English-speaking Cameroonians who say they are fed up with an ongoing separatist war are taking matters into their own hands by arresting and handing over suspected separatist fighters to the military. Some residents also have created militias in their towns and villages as they voice frustration over the war that has killed more than close to 2,000 people. Moki Edwin Kanzeka reports from Yaounde.
Yeah, you can see the population is jubilating now.
In the English-speaking village of Pinyin, a man shouts alongside scores of people who voice jubilation over the arrest of four suspected fighters. Among the residents is 45-year-old Butcher Peter Ndifo, a village self-defense group member. Ndifo says he participated in the arrests because the situation has worsened by the day since the war started in 2017. He says people are dying and businesses are crumbling.
At first, we used to slaughter about 5-6 cow a day. But presently now, we slaughter just one or two, but it cannot even get finished again. It has affected my business a lot.
The suspected separatists, armed with locally made guns, were overpowered by the huge crowd that attacked their hideout. The four men did not shoot, but received severe beatings before they were handed to the military. Separatists have said on social media that the arrested men are not their fighters. They say the armed men may either have been taking advantage of the fight to kidnap people for ransom, or were sent by the government to disguise themselves as fighters in order to attack and give information to the military. Cameroon's unrest began in 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers protested the growing dominance of the French language in the officially bilingual country. The government responded with a crackdown, and separatists began using weapons against the military, alleging that they were defending their people and fighting for their independence. Last week, attacks on suspected separatist fighters were reported in the English-speaking southwestern towns of Motengene and Tiko. Political analyst Gilbert Mba says many people have voiced irritation with the war because there is no end in sight and conditions are worsening.
The population are really fed up with it. Because 3 years is not 3 days. The economy is really down. Children in the house, no food, no school, everything. I mean, it's really very bad.
Cameroon has been using village militias on its northern border with Nigeria to fight Boko Haram terrorists with the hope the armed locals can prevent further attacks. Paul Atanganji, Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, says the government is relying on such groups to defend their communities from intruders.
Look at what is happening in the far north region. The vigilante groups are very operational because there's that synergy between the vigilante groups and the forces of law and order. When the suicide bombers are coming, they go and stop them. If we think that only the military can intervene, it becomes difficult.
The militias live on donations and expect support from the government. This was the case with village militias on Cameroon's border with Nigeria. Atanganji says the population should be watchful and collaborate with them, making sure that people with questionable character do not join them. Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions have been wrecked with instability since fighting broke out. More than 1,800 people have been killed and 500,000 internally displaced, according to the UN. A battle between the militias and the fighters in the English-speaking village of Mbot last week left 2 militias dead. 6 suspected separatists also were killed. The violence has also kept more than 600,000 children out of school and disrupted healthcare services as well as the economy. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
South Africa's African National Congress Party retained its hold on parliament in last week's election. Now the focus is on what kind of cabinet President Cyril Ramaphosa will appoint. The president is facing strong pressure to appoint a cabinet of technocrats, not his political allies. However, some experts say Ramaphosa must balance the interests of competing factions within his party and ministers accused of corruption. Tuso Kamalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
During the campaign, South African voters made it clear they want lower unemployment, greater access to basic services like clean water and electricity, and an end to corruption. All eyes are now on President Cyril Ramaphosa to deliver, and he will need an efficient cabinet to do it. In his recent address to an investors' conference in Johannesburg, he hinted that he has been listening to South Africans' demands for a performance-oriented cabinet.
I will be seeking to get men and women who have great competence, great capability to serve the needs of the people of South Africa.
But others say that is easier said than done. The ANC is heavily divided between his supporters and those who supported former President Jacob Zuma, and both factions want fair representation. Political analyst Sipho Siyebe says recent bickering between party officials show just how difficult Ramaphosa's task will be.
He must balance the political forces that exist within the ANC. He is not going to act as if he's a lone ranger, because if he does that, then he can suffer the same fate as other presidents have done in the past.
Former President Thabo Mbeki and Zuma were recalled by opposing factions before the end of their terms. With unemployment at 28%, Hanky Madabane, president of the Black Business Council, says Ramaphosa must appoint ministers who can tackle the country's big economic issues.
The economy is not creating jobs. Unemployment is still at its highest, and inequality is also still high. So it's to attend to those macro issues.
Ramaphosa's current cabinet has several ministers who are facing serious corruption allegations. Some ministers who had resigned over the allegations are also now back in parliament and are set to be sworn in on Wednesday. The opposition has warned these are signs the ANC is not ready to deal with corruption. Economist Kaya Stolle says the president must resist pressure to make appointments based on party interest and political appeasement.
He will need a very strong team and a very strong cabinet, and this cabinet shouldn't just be based on loyalty, but really be based on the ability of people to really then assist them in driving those agendas, in reviving the policies and making sure they're implemented properly.
Ramaphosa is also facing calls to reduce the size of the cabinet, which now stands at 30 ministers and 37 deputies. He will be inaugurated on May 25. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In the Gambia, the army has announced an ambitious farming program in which it says will ease a lack of food in the West African country. Employing 1,000 Gambian youth, the army says the project will help combat the problem of migration from rural areas to urban ones. Reporter Pa Nderi Mbai has the details.
The army says it is partnering with a South African-American company to help make the Gambia a food-sufficient and exporting nation. This followed over two decades of free labor that the army had been rendering to exiled dictator Yahya Jammeh, who used to make them to work on his farmland for free. Soldiers and officers who refused often risk getting fired or imprisoned. Major Lamin K. Sanyang is spokesman for the Gambian Army.
As part of the ongoing reforms, the Gambian Armed Forces is looking at diversifying its roles and responsibilities in order to reposition itself in the productive sectors of the Gambia. We are looking at a whole range of agricultural products, from rice production to moringa, aquaculture to animal husbandry, and so on. This is born out of our conviction that we have the personnel, the discipline, we are organized, focused, and professional.
Sanyang says Army Chief of Defense Staff Masane Kinte introduced the project last month to President Adama Barrow during a meeting between the Army and their partners from the South African-based Aqua Group. The company designs, manufactures, and distributes agricultural equipment. Sanyang says the government spends $48 million, about $1 million each year, just to buy rice to feed its troops.
We want these millions being spent on the purchase of meat, rice, or fish for the armed forces to be invested elsewhere.
Besides cutting government expenditures on the army, Sanyang notes that the project will create employment opportunities for Gambia's unemployed youths.
The plan is to dedicate a whole battalion, that is 1,000 personnel, 30% of which shall comprise youth from the beneficiary communities who shall be employed by the project to feed the army. In addition, we are confident that with the appropriate incentives, the Gambia Armed Forces has the capacity to feed the nation and even export outside of this country. It is envisaged that the employment of these youths will in turn help to mitigate rural-urban migration as well as illegal migration of our youths.
Colonel S.R. Tamba is the point person for the project. Tamba maintains that the Gambian Army has been empowered by the Constitution to embark on such an agricultural venture. This followed sentiments expressed in some quarters by critics who argued that the project was a misplaced priority. Both Tamba and the Army spokesman dismissed such claims.
The armed forces did not only get up one day and jumped into farming. As he already shared, we studied on the whole situation, analyzed it, and made our own research. And we have collaborated with some of our sister African countries whose army are also involved in such ventures. And we already know what those people are contributing to their GDP. And we are quite certain that if those people can do it for their country, we can do tenfold better in our own country.
The army has secured over 50,000 hectares of rural land. Top on its agenda are rice cultivation, animal husbandry, and poultry management. For VOA Africa, this is Pandirim by reporting.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Stand up!